happen in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Welcome to The End of Innocence. I'm your host, John Young. The release of JFK documents and testimony since the 1990s has undermined the official story of the lone gunman. While Representative Anna Paulina Luna was criticized in March for rejecting the lone gunman conclusion of the Warren Commission, she had solid evidence to back her position. Dr. Robert McClellan, one of the Dallas doctors who tried to save JFK's life, said he was quite certain that JFK was killed by a shot fired from the front of his limousine, a shot that could not have been fired by Lee Harvey Oswald, the accused assassin. Quote, "That shot came from the grassy knoll," end quote, McClellan said in a 2013 interview. The full release of 77,000 pages of previously redacted JFK records on March 18th revealed new clues about the events that led to JFK's death. A declassified transcript showed CIA counterintelligence chief James Angleton lied under oath about his mail surveillance of Lee Harvey Oswald before Kennedy's death, making him the third CIA official, besides George Joannides and Director Richard Helms, known to have lied about their knowledge of the accused assassin who denied killing Kennedy. Another memo, long known but not fully declassified until March, revealed that Garrett Underhill, an arms dealer associated with the CIA, told friends that a, quote, small clique in the CIA was responsible for JFK's murder. When Underhill was found dead of a supposed suicide, his friends doubted that he had killed himself. While many previously hidden files have been released, and researchers and historians are still combing through the 77,000 pages, the CIA continues to withhold some very crucial documents. However, last Friday, a CIA official assured Representative Anna Paulina Luna, chair of the House Task Force on Declassification of Federal Secrets, that long-held secret files related to the assassination of President Kennedy would be released within weeks. That's doubtful. Luna said she was told that the CIA had located four of the five files that she had demanded in a letter to CIA Director John Ratcliffe last month. Luna stated, quote, "The timeline for the release will be weeks. The fact that they've delivered on what we asked for before is a good sign. I expect they will deliver again," end quote. Luna said the CIA official she spoke to told her he could not reveal which one of the files she requested had not been found by the agency. The two-term Republican from Florida speculated that it was the personnel file of George Joannides, an undercover officer whose agents generated propaganda about Lee Harvey Oswald before and after JFK was killed on November 22, 1963. The George Joannides file has been in the news since 2009, when the New York Times reported the CIA was, quote, cagey about its classified contents. In 2013, Associated Press and Fox News highlighted the continuing secrecy around the Joannides file on the 50th anniversary of JFK's death. 12 years and 4 months later, after Trump's executive order on JFK files, the CIA is still unwilling to say publicly when it will produce any of the 44 top-secret documents in the George Joannides file. Luna said she had been working diligently with Director of National Intelligence Tulsa Gabbard to close the loop on the Joannides file. Asked if the CIA was slow-walking the release of the JFK files, Luna replied, she believes the agency personnel are acting in good faith to comply with Trump's order. Executive Order 14176, issued by President Trump in January, calls for full and complete disclosure of JFK records in the government's possession. The 1992 JFK Records Act, likewise, gives all assassination-related material the presumption of immediate disclosure. Other documents that Luna says she has been promised by the CIA include a 1979 report from the CIA Inspector General's Office about Congress's JFK investigation, which a whistleblower claims last October showed an intent to deceive JFK investigators. She's also been promised the travel records of William K. Harvey, who was a chief of the CIA's assassination program and was reportedly in Dallas in November of 63. And last, but certainly not least, a file I've been waiting on the whole time. The file of Herminio Diaz Garcia, a Cuban gunman whose associates came to believe was involved in JFK's assassination. In a newly released document, an FBI informant said 4 days after JFK's murder that Diaz was working for the CIA. In last week's episode, we covered part one of what Warren Report defenders and supporters must believe in order to claim Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone or even was an assassin at all in the death of President John F. Kennedy. I'd planned on doing part two this week, but feel like it is very important to bring our listeners and subscribers details from the latest hearing of the Task Force on Declassification of JFK Files, which was held this past Tuesday. Witnesses testifying Tuesday include Judge John Tenaham, the former chair of the civilian panel that declassified millions of pages of JFK documents in recent years. In 2022, Tenaham called on President Biden to release the Joe Needy's file in its entirety. Biden ignored the recommendation, the rare Biden policy that the Trump administration has continued to follow. Another one testifying on Tuesday was Dan Hardaway, a congressional investigator who was personally deceived by Joe Needy's in 1978. Another witness testifying was Abraham Bolden, who was the first African-American Secret Service agent appointed directly by John F. Kennedy. Bolden learned of a plot against JFK in November of 1963. Another witness testifying Tuesday was Don Curtis, a doctor at Parkland Hospital on November 22, 1963. He identified an interest wound, a, quote, bullet hole in the right temple of JFK. Curtis says in his testimony, quote, the magic bullet was a product of the Warren Commission and doesn't make any sense, end quote. His testimony, along with seven other Parkland doctors that treated JFK that day, proves that there was a frontal shot to Kennedy and a giant hole in the back of his head caused by an exit wound. Another key witness testifying Tuesday was Doug Horn. Doug served on the Assassinations Record Review Board for the final 3 years of its four-year lifespan. While serving with the Assassinations Record Review Board, Mr. Horn was a key participant in taking the depositions of 10 witnesses and participants to the JFK autopsy in 1963 and became one of the ARRB staff experts on the famous Zapruder film of the assassination. In this testimony, Congress heard from five JFK whistleblowers. No conspiracy theories. Only eyewitness testimony to government deception over 60 years. As House Select Committee on Assassinations investigator Dan Hardaway said, quote, none of this would have happened if one man alone killed the president, end quote.
Joining us now is Jefferson Morley. He's a journalist and author and editor of the JFK Facts Substack newsletter. He testified last month at the very first House committee hearing on the JFK assassination files. So you were in the first hearing. I'm sure you watched the second one closely. What did you make of what you heard today?
Well, I thought it was remarkable that you had five witnesses from five men who had personally experienced the government's attempts to block them from investigating JFK's assassination. And the testimony we heard was quite convincing from multiple witnesses that the CIA is obstructing, did obstruct, and is obstructing the JFK investigation to this day. You know, Representative Luna called attention to the fact that she's asked the CIA and Director Ratcliffe for five JFK-related documents. They're clearly relevant to the assassination. And the CIA said they would produce none of them in time for this hearing, and that they might not produce them ever. And so, you know, it was remarkable that that was really laid out on the line, and the ball is in the CIA's court. How do they explain the fact that they are withholding these records to this day, even in defiance of Trump's order?
I mean, it's going to say, hasn't the president ordered these documents, all of them released? How can the CIA continue to withhold them?
Well, you know, Representative Luna told me that she had a conversation with a CIA official last week. And she said that they promised her that they would produce four of the five records within a week. No date specified, and no guarantee that she would get all of them. So that alone is a non-cooperative attitude towards the president's order. And it's really disturbing because it's very consistent with what these other witnesses said. Dr. Curtis talked about being treated in a coercive, abusive way by Warren Commission lawyer Arlen Specter.
He actually said he was, quote, terrorized by the Warren Commission. I was struck by his choice of that word.
Yeah, I mean, there was a real effort to intimidate people out of coming forward. Secret Service agent Abraham Bolden testified remotely at 90 years old to talk about how he had been railroaded and put in jail because he raised questions about the security procedures around Kennedy. So really powerful testimony of people who saw this firsthand. And now the ball's in the court of the Trump administration and the CIA. Are they going to produce these records or not?
We heard a lot today about somebody named George Ioannidis. Yes. He was an undercover officer who ran a secret operation on Lee Harvey Oswald 3 months before the assassination. Demanding records on him, but for years, this is one of the records the CIA has refused to hand over.
This is the key to the whole story. And the fact that they're not turning over this file, this is the smoking gun, Elizabeth.
Why is it the key? Why do you think it's the key?
Because George Ioannidis, he was the chief of covert action at the CIA's Miami station in 1963. His paid agent generated propaganda about Oswald before and after the assassination. None of this was disclosed to the Warren Commission. None of it was disclosed to the House Select Committee on Assassinations in 1978. Even 30 years later, Judge Tunheim, the head of the Assassination Records Review Board in the 1990s, said the CIA deliberately misled, that's a quote, deliberately misled us about Ioannidis' actions in 1963. This is the ball game, Elizabeth. This is the one thing that they're determined to keep off the public record. And frankly, they're in sign of slow motion defiance of Trump's. They're not defying it. They're just saying
they're slow walking it.
They're slow walking.
We're familiar with the procedure, having dealt with various governments over my entire career. Yeah, I know what that looks like. Jefferson Morley, we'll have you back because I'm sure this story will continue. Thank you so much.
The task force on the declassification of federal secrets will come to order. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for being here today. I wanted to thank our witnesses, especially those who have traveled far to be here. Over the last 60 years, on a crowded street in Dallas, Texas, the president of the United States was assassinated in front of a horrified crowd, his Secret Service protection, and his wife. The death of President Kennedy was a monumentous and tragic day for the entire nation, as well as the Kennedy family. The country has never been the same since. Compounding that tragedy, however, has been the over 60 years of half-truths, deception, and outright lies that the federal government has offered regarding the details of that day and the events surrounding it. I want to thank the National Archives for their cooperation with this task force. The archives have provided these posters behind us that were allegedly produced for the CIA to show President Johnson on the days following the assassination. They are, of course, images of the Zapruder film that Americans have come to know as capturing the final moments of President Kennedy's death or life. What the Americans have come to understand about the assassination of President Kennedy has mostly been controlled and filtered through assent and watchful gaze of federal agencies who have often resisted efforts to reveal the truth. They have done this at best because of their own embarrassment about their failures to protect President Kennedy that day. At worst, they have resisted for more nefarious reasons, such as failing to acknowledge the extent of power and reach that the CIA in the 1960s had and beyond to the point of deceiving even the United States Congress. That is why we are here today. We are here to listen to the witnesses who have waited, in some cases, decades to tell their stories. I want to be clear, the Task Force on Declassification of Federal Secrets is not here to provide the definitive account of what happened on November 22, 1963. Instead, the Task Force is meant to root out the hidden pockets of federal government that has for too long remained in the shadows of our reach, out of our reach for even good faith investigators to reach. I also want to thank President Trump for committing to the principles of transparency and holding the government accountable to the people. His executive order regarding the declassification of documents related to the assassination of President Kennedy, Senator Robert F. Kennedy, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is a step forward in the right direction. The job of the task force is to ensure that the federal agencies follow that order, because in the past, a president's order for transparency has not always been heeded by the most secretive portions of our government. The objective of this task force is not to indulge in conspiracy theories, but to push forward the release of information so these theories can be put to bed and so the American people can finally have truth. It is the federal agencies that lack transparency for 6 years that have led to the people's distrust in their government, and it's time to restore that. I would also like to provide, for those who have been closely following this, to include researchers, an update on several documents that are outstanding. To date, the Joanides files has not been located. A whistleblower report from the CIA alleging the CIA's implication has also not been located. Lee Harvey Oswald's travel records have not been located. And the DS-201 file, who was a plausible suspect for the Delaney Plaza shooter, and then as well as the MSATA documents concerning CIA penetration of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. Last week, for an update, I did speak to the CIA directly, and they did notify me that 4 of these 5 documents would be publicly released in the coming weeks, but there was one that was outstanding, and I do believe that that one outstanding document is the Joanides file. Without further ado, I'd like to yield this next portion to Ranking Member Garcia.
Thank you, Chairwoman Luna. I want to note, thank you to the witnesses that are here. Now, as the task force continues its work, we need to continue to follow the facts and provide transparency for the American people. I think we can all agree that the task force was not set up to chase conspiracy theories, and I'm glad, of course, to have Chairwoman Luna reiterate that. It's responsible, though, for us to focus on declassification of historical records, and that allows, as we all know, the public to gain a better understanding of the past and restore trust in our institutions and ensures accountability in our shared government. Now, on March 18, 2025, the National Archives and Records released more than 77,000 pages related, of course, to the November 22, 1963 assassination of President Kennedy. Now, we know that many of these documents, most in fact, were already in the public record. Continued work to make the documents more accessible is important and valuable. Now, over the past several decades, our government has collected and released almost 6 million pages of documents consistent with President John F. Kennedy and the Assassination Records Collection Act of 1992. Now, together, we should push back on decades of overclassification relating not to just the JFK assassination, but a variety of subjects. We should be very clear, and it should be done in a bipartisan way, that the FBI and the CIA of the 1960s were deeply flawed institutions. And while they have taken lessons from their past trespasses, there is no question that they have continued to often overclassify information, often out of an unnecessary abundance of caution. And it's also important to note that the FBI and CIA did harm in numerous areas over the last 2 decades, particularly when you look at the time of the civil rights movement. Now, transparency is how we ensure accountability and trust. The American people have the right to know as much as possible about what our government does and how our tax dollars are spent in a way that doesn't, of course, interfere with national security. I understand the interest in a second hearing on President Kennedy's assassination, but I hope our task force can continue to work in a bipartisan way on the many other topics under its purview that are also important to the public. Now, as we hear testimony from our witnesses today, I want to make sure that we remember that President Kennedy's assassination is more than a historical event. It was also a human tragedy. President Kennedy was a husband, a father, a brother, and a son. Revisiting and relitigating a tragic killing was also painful for the real people that were impacted and for the family. And I think it's important to uplift that. We should be respectful and responsible as we work to address the public's questions about the tragedy. And we know that President Kennedy's legacy has made America the country that it is today. At a time when we're looking, of course, and the majority is pushing for tax cuts, oftentimes for the wealthiest, we need to remember that President Kennedy believed in a society where Americans took care of one another. He fought to expand and lay the groundwork for the program, which, of course, became Medicare, which was enacted under President Johnson. He, of course, is a huge proponent of advancing civil rights, and President Kennedy proposed the Civil Rights Act, which became a landmark law in 1964. With support of the court and the rule of law, which we know that President Kennedy worked tirelessly to enforce, of course, courts, support courts, and orders, even sending U.S. Marshals and the National Guard to desegregate the University of Mississippi. Social security was also critical to President Kennedy. He worked to expand social security to increase benefits and cover more people with disabilities. President Kennedy, over and over again, of course, believed that government could do big things. He invested in scientific discovery and challenged us to put a man on the moon. We know, and he knew, that our country was strongest as a global leader fighting for freedom and democracy. He believed in working through our alliances. And I want to make sure that the family also knows that we will work and always work to uplift President Kennedy's legacy and what he left for the country and the community. It's important that we follow the facts, and that we work to continue and declassify. Oftentimes, things have been overclassified by particularly the FBI and the CIA in the past. Thank you, and I yield back.
Our witnesses here today are pretty historical. Joining us via Zoom, we actually have Mr. Abraham Bolden. Mr. Bolden was an agent with the U.S. Secret Service appointed by President Kennedy in 1961. And sir, we want to thank you very much for attending today. We are very happy that you are here. We also have Dr. Don Curtis. Dr. Curtis was a resident in oral and facial surgery at Parkland Hospital in Dallas. And at 12:45 p.m. on November 22nd, 1963, he was actually in the trauma room one attempting to save President Kennedy's life. He is joining us today in person. Dr. Judge Tunheim, Mr. Tunheim is currently a federal district judge in Minnesota, but previously served as President Bill Clinton's chair of the Assassinations Record Review Board, as well as Mr. Hardway. Mr. Hardway was an investigator with the Select Committee on Assassinations of the House of Representatives, as well as Mr. Douglas Horn. Mr. Horn was a staff at the Assassination Record Review Board. Do you so solemnly swear and affirm that the testimony that you are about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? Thank you. Let the record show that the witnesses have answered in the affirmative. The task force certainly appreciates you for being here today, and we look forward to hearing your testimony. Let me remind you and the witnesses that we have read your written statements and that they will appear in record in full. And as an accommodation, because of the historic nature of this testimony, please also be ensured that you will not be rushed for your opening statements. I now recognize Mr. Bolden to give an opening statement.
The man John F. Kennedy called the Jackie Robinson of the Secret Service finally got to testify before a congressional committee Tuesday, alleging fellow agents were often drunk on the job, and there was a so-called, quote, Chicago plot to kill the president before his 1963 assassination in Dallas. With his head bowed, Abraham Bolden, who is 90 years old, spoke with difficulty into a microphone when he addressed the Committee on Oversight and Government Reform by Zoom from his home in Chicago. The audio cut off immediately as Bolden began to speak, effectively muting his testimony on the live stream.
Okay, we are going to move to Dr. Curtis while you guys work through the mic issue, but Mr. Bolden, please be assured we will be coming back to you. So we'll just pass. Dr. Curtis, if you can.
Thank you. My story begins when I left my office to go to get something to eat before I did surgery. And to do that, I had to go by the emergency room. And when I went by the emergency room, a policeman came out of the door into the emergency room, grabbed my shoulder, and he said, "Are you a doctor?" So the policeman asked me if I was a doctor, and I said yes. And he grabbed me by the arm and pulled me into the emergency room and took me to the trauma room. And when I looked in the trauma room, there were three people in the room. One was the president, and he was laying on the gurney in treatments. And the other was Dr. Carrico, James Carrico. And the reason Dr. Carrico was on his own is because Governor Connally was brought in before him. And he was very seriously ill. And all the staff in the emergency room went to help him. And then Dr. Carrico was left to take care of the president by himself. So I walked in, and he had just placed an endotracheal tube. And then I walked up and held the tube so he could connect the bird machine to it. And he had already made a decision. He said, "Tracheostomy, we need to do a trach. If there was going to be a trach, well, I knew the shirt would be in the way." So I moved around to take the shirt off, and the nurses were way ahead of me with their scissors. We took the shirt off. And in the meantime, Dr. Malcolm Perry came in, and he's on the medical staff. He's a professor in the medical school, senior to Dr. Carrico. So he decided to do tracheotomy. And then Dr. Carrico said to me, "Don, I want to go ahead and do it to cut down on that left leg." After I did that, then Dr. Perry had already completed the tracheotomy. The president had, the heart had stopped, or one of the monitor on the president found out his heart was not bleeding. And so the internal cardiac massage was being done by Kemp Clark, the chief of neurosurgery. And somebody relieved him, and Kemp Clark went and picked up the hand
It's a stop their resuscitation. His mind is not compatible with life. He got the kid quiet. Nobody knew what to say. Nobody said anything for the longest time. Then he said, okay. And then he looked at, by that time, the chiefs of all the surgical services were against the wall across the room from me. They're all in white coats, and they had responded to the call that they needed help. And so he said, pointing them out, I need to tell each of you individually what the wound is, so that you can say that later on. And then he described the wound as about a 3 or 4 inch hole, posterior cranium. There's a hole at the right temple. So he described it, but the bullet came through the temple into the cranial vault. He had huge pressure in the cranial vault. And when the bullet finally tumbled into the posterior wall, it blew it up. He explained all that to individually to each five doctors, seven doctors. And those doctors knew what was happening to the president, the one that killed him. They never were called by the Warren Commission. So basically everybody left. And I went around and looked at the wound, and I could see it was laying on the pillow, but I could see. And I left there and went into the adjacent room. The x-ray waiting room was a large room. And right in the middle of the room was Lyndon Johnson. And he was telling people to go talk on the phone. And obviously, he set the government up, and he was taking control. And then I looked around, and I couldn't see a single person I thought looked like Secret Service. I couldn't see any weapons that were protecting him. So I was a little uncomfortable being there myself. But at that time, we had no idea what was going on in our government. We thought the government would be intact. Well, it made me feel good to know that he was right in the middle of the room. He was the president. He was absolutely fearless. Then I wondered, why is he so absolutely fearless? I mean, it's clear he'd be the next one to go. One thing I'd like to get started today is that Magic Bullet was a product of the Warren Commission that was making sense. There, you go through these bullets that fell, but I think I'm out of time.
Well, so just so you know, we will be giving you opportunity to go back to that because we are very interested in that, and thank you for that. Now, I would like to recognize Mr. Hardway for an opening statement.
Thank you. For the past 62 years, the Central Intelligence Agency has actively and continuously obstructed the investigation of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy with no consequences for their actions. 10 years ago, the CIA's official historian admitted that the CIA had hidden information from the Warren Commission during its investigation. The CIA stonewalled the Senate Select Committee to study governmental operations with respect to intelligence activities, the Church Committee. The CIA was not forthcoming with the Rockefeller Commission. The CIA misled and slow-walked the Assassination Records Review Board. James Angleton's preferred method in dealing with the Warren Commission was to, quote, wait them out. The first CIA officer I ever interviewed looked at me and said, you represent Congress. What the F is that to the CIA? You'll be gone in 2 years, and we'll still be here. In 1978, the CIA ran an illegal domestic covert operation involving an undercover officer to subvert and obstruct the House Select Committee on Assassinations. That officer served undercover. That terminology is the terminology the CIA used to describe his assignment working with the Select Committee in a statement that their representative made under penalties of perjury in a lawsuit in 2005. I personally experienced the CIA's obstruction of the HSC investigation and can testify firsthand about what happened. In 1977 and 1978, I was employed as a researcher by the Select Committee, and I have submitted a detailed 17-page description of what happened then and since then, which I hope you will read. Briefly, my primary area of responsibility was Lee Harvey Oswald's activities in Mexico City in the fall of 1963 and the performance of the CIA in monitoring and reporting those activities, as well as other issues related to the possibility of CIA knowledge of or involvement in the assassination of President Kennedy and the cover-up of information relevant to the investigation of the assassination. In that capacity, I had a top-secret security clearance, and during the major portion of my employment, had access to unredacted CIA records requested for review from the CIA by the Select Committee. Implicit in the focus of my work was the issue of whether the evidence from Mexico indicated any operational connection between Oswald and the CIA. Ed Lopez and I authored the report, The CIA, Oswald, and Mexico City. In the spring of 1978, among other things, I was looking hard into back-channel communications methods used by the Mexico City station, the use of an impulse camera to photograph the Cuban consulate in Mexico City, missing production from that impulse camera, and from one of the photographic installations that covered the Soviet embassy in Mexico City, and David Atlee Phillips' anti-Castro propaganda operations, including his connections to stories about Oswald that rapidly appeared after the assassination of John Kennedy. In May of 1978, the CIA assigned an officer working in an undercover capacity to work with me and Mr. Lopez. That man was George Ioannidis. When Ioannidis was introduced to the investigation, we were told that he had no connection of any kind with any aspect of the Kennedy case that we would be investigating. In addition to that, the CIA assured us that they had no working relationship with an anti-Castro Cuban group known as DRE. They had no relationship with the DRE when representatives of that group had an encounter with Oswald in the summer of 1963, which they turned into quite a propaganda coup. The DRE was responsible for the first ever conspiracy theory about the assassination when the day after the assassination, they published in their newspaper the story about Oswald's pro-Castro activities in New Orleans and proposed that Castro was behind the assassination, a story that was picked up the next day by the Washington Post and the Miami Herald. Thanks to the work of the Assassination Records Review Board, though, we now know that not only was DRE still a CIA operation all the way through 1963 and all the way up to April 1964, its controlling case officer, who oversaw the activities of the DRE and directed the DRE's activities, was no one other than George Ioannidis. I believe we were close to some major discoveries in 1978. And then the CIA ran an undercover operation against us. They assigned us a man who knew exactly how to keep us from finding what we were looking for, and he proceeded to do just that. Reasonable inferences may be drawn about what they did not want us to find from the substantial circumstantial evidence that has come to light by our efforts and those of the Assassination Records Review Board and the journalist Jefferson Morley. I am a witness to these events. As such, I have a civic duty to testify. I wish I were just here. Actually, I wish I weren't here. But I wish I were just here to talk about a cover-up. But I'm not. I'm here to talk about a CIA covert operation directed against the Select Committee on Assassinations that was illegal and a violation of the CIA's charter, as well as being a felonious obstruction of a congressional investigation. That operation was and continues to be successful. despite our testimony, and by that I mean mine, Ed Lopez's, and G. Robert Blakey's, and the clear record, no one has ever done anything about it. I have copies of the sworn testimony and exhibits of all three of us in D.C. District Court case number 17 CV 1433. I have those records with me if any of the members of this task force would like to see them. The question for this task force is whether anyone in this new generation of leaders has the backbone, the courage, the gumption to try to do something even at this late date. It's easy to admit and air the sins of our ancestors. It is much harder to admit that we build their tombs and endorse their actions by our inaction. I'm here to testify again, which is all that I can do. What will you do?
Thank you, Mr. Hardaway. I now recognize Judge Tunheim for an opening statement.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Ranking Member. Appreciate this opportunity to speak today. My name is John Tunheim. I'm a federal district court judge for the District of Minnesota. I'm in my 30th year as a federal judge. I served as chief judge of our district from 2015 until 2022, and as a member of the U.S. Judicial Conference from 2020 to 2024. I was originally nominated by President Clinton in 1995 after serving 10 years as the Minnesota's Chief Deputy Attorney General. I was chair of the Assassination Records Review Board during its entire existence from 1994 through 1998. The review board was an independent federal agency. Five board members were confirmed by the U.S. Senate after being nominated by President Clinton. Congress created the review board for the express purpose of reviewing all of the still secret records of the tragic assassination of President John Kennedy and declassifying as much information as could be publicly released. The impetus for the law, which was enacted in October 1992, was Oliver Stone's movie JFK. The President John F. Kennedy Assassination Records Collection Act of 1992 provided for a five-member decision-making board, which would make decisions on agency-requested redactions from classified documents. We had declassification authority. First time and maybe the only time an outside group had that authority. The board members were, by law, to be recommended for appointment by professional organizations, two National Historical Associations, an Archivists Association, and the American Bar Association. Besides me, the members included a renowned provost from a major university, later university president, two distinguished history professors, and a senior archivist at Princeton. We were confirmed in 1994 and began our work with no appropriation or offices. We worked out of the National Archives for a time until I was able to secure some funding from the White House to get us started before Congress could provide an appropriation. The agency's presentation of records was seriously delayed because of the delay in the appointments. We were ready to begin review with our staff by early 1995. The statute did not require us to reach any conclusions about prior investigations or what happened on November 22nd. Rather, our task was to conduct a wide-ranging search for records to create the largest possible collection of assassination-related records as open to the public as possible. The goal was to allow the interested public to make up their own minds about what happened and based on an open and transparent and complete record. The congressional mandate, and this is important, it stated that the records relating to the assassination would, quote, carry a presumption of immediate disclosure. And, quote, only in the rarest of cases is there any legitimate need for continued protection. This is Congress in 1992. Congress defined the term assassination records broadly and indicated that the review board could further define the term assassination record, which we did. So in June of 1995, our definition was that any record that was reasonably related who the assassination would be an assassination record subject to the board jurisdiction. And we included all records collected by government agencies in conjunction with any investigation or analysis of or inquiry into the assassination of President Kennedy. We developed detailed guidelines for agencies to follow, and agencies did have the right to appeal our decisions directly to the president. We were authorized to redact words. We did not ever redact entire documents. That the agency proved by clear and convincing evidence, that was the standard, that the harm of disclosure outweighed the public interest in the document in four categories: national security, intelligence gathering methods, personal privacy, or methods of protecting the president. That was it. We held many public hearings, experts conferences around the country, in addition to our private meetings to discuss our decision making. We also tried to clarify unclear evidence where we could, digitalizing autopsy materials and analyzing them, and deposing the autopsy physicians. We also gathered artifacts, including photographs and film, clothing, and other artifacts. We had limited time to do our work, which was not enough time. We were granted just one more year by Congress, so we had a total of 3 years. We began to lose staff as we approached the end of our mandate. In all, the board issued over 27,000 individual rulings. These were decisions on requests by agencies to protect information. Most redacted information had release dates attached to them. We made it easy for the researchers to determine whether a redacted name appeared in different locations so that they would know it was the same person. There were a further 33,000 consent releases, which is essentially means that the agency saw the handwriting on the wall and released the documents directly, since we were likely to order release. When we finished, there were nearly 5 million pages at the National Archives. We made the decision early that we would not protect any information directly related to the assassination because of the high level of public interest. By 2017, when the last records were to be released under the Act, there were probably not more than 1,500 review board redactions that were remaining. The Act was clear in stating that despite the review board wrapping up its work in 1998, the Act was to continue in effect, which meant that agencies had the obligation to continue to present information. Most of the redactions now in the documents are within documents never shown to the review board, but were transferred to NARA at a later time. Agencies largely complied with the mandate to present records to the review board. However, there are many delays and denials with records that we specifically requested, and there were many skirmishes along the way. It does not take a rocket scientist to realize that agencies were awaiting the end of our three-year mandate. The first 500 or so adverse disclosure decisions we made in FBI records were appealed to the president, and the appeals were dropped when White House counsel, former judge, and Representative Abner Mikva told the FBI to drop the appeals because President Clinton would deny all of them. FBI staff was helpful to us, but I'm now seeing records in the new releases that were not disclosed to the review board. The CIA was cooperative and processed many documents with us, but we never received much of what we specifically asked for. When asked, for example, for documents involving James Angleton that we had not seen, I was told the documents were no longer maintained as a collection. We received only three memoranda that incorporated the agency's review of Angleton's counterintelligence files. Not the files themselves, just a review by someone else of the files. We were told that all the other documents had been destroyed. I'm now seeing a flood of documents that clearly meet the definition of assassination record involving Angleton and others that were not submitted to us for review. When CIA analysts would not tell us the details of their secret operations, our response was, okay, we'll release the record in 10 days. We then heard the details and could make a reasonable decision. We had in our hands a small file on George Ioannidis that was disclosed. It disclosed nothing really, so it was returned. We didn't know the details of his work at the time. We now know much more about Ioannidis, and his files should be immediately disclosed. There's no reason anymore for protecting those files. Clearly, we were misled. I actually wrote to President Biden asking that he order the CIA to release the Ioannidis file, and I never received a response. The Secret Service was very difficult. They were the only agency that we were aware of that tried to reclassify assassination records after we were in office. They attempted to classify documents that had already been released publicly and fought us over 1963 threat sheets that were still in process when we left office. The Department of State was less than helpful, although they released records in their possession. When we negotiated with Russian officials over the Oswald files in Moscow, they did not lift a finger to help us, not even allowing us access to the United States Embassy. When we tried to get access to Belarusian records on Oswald, they did not help. When we planned meetings with Mexican and Cuban officials, they stopped us from direct contacts. The act specifically required the Department of State to help us find foreign record. The National Archives was very helpful to us when we did our work. A very dedicated staff member, Stephen Tilley, was instrumental in getting our work done. But since we left office, I've been disappointed the Archives has not devoted more personnel to the records. We had planned that the Archives would continue our work to the extent possible. For the most part, that has not happened, and the agency has never been in contact with me. So there are other files that should be released. We came close to an agreement to copy the entire KGB file on Lee Harvey Oswald. It is maintained in Minsk, Belarus. Last-minute disputes prevented the agreement from moving forward. Copies of the files are in Moscow. I just have a little bit more here. We were particularly interested in the files of Walter Sheridan, an investigator for Robert Kennedy. When we took office, he removed the files from the Kennedy Library, where we had access to them, and gave them to NBC for safekeeping. I don't think those files have been released. The William Manchester taped interviews of Jacqueline and Robert Kennedy are protected by a 1967 legal agreement, now controlled by Caroline Kennedy. We encouraged her to release the files, and she finally responded in August 1998 that she would not agree to their release or even let us listen to the recording. And out there somewhere are files on Jack Ruby. We could not find them other than the files maintained by the earlier investigations. In the final report of the board, a copy of which I will give to Madam Chair today, we made 10 recommendations that are relevant today still. I won't go through them all, but they deal with the problems of excessive government secrecy, which has plagued the public's understanding of the Kennedy assassination for decades. We strongly endorse the method selected for independent declassification of executive branch records that was used in our case, but also detailed the problems inherent in the review board's legislation. Most important, to deal with massive overclassification, we recommended a federal classification policy be developed that substantially, one, limits the number of those in government who can actually classify federal documents, two, restricts the number of categories by which documents might be classified, three, reduces the time period for which documents might be classified, four, encourages the use of substitute language to immediately open material that might otherwise be classified, and five, increases the resources available to agencies and NARA for declassifying federal records. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. And just so everyone knows, we are going to be following up on getting that file, the KGB file in Minsk. I'm interested in seeing that. And I think that with peace talks right now, it might be prime time for that. So we will be following up on that.
It stands about 5 feet high. It's also correct.
Well, we might have to bring you back out of retirement, what you're currently doing, and have you help go through with that. I'd like to now recognize Mr. Horn for an opening statement.
Chairwoman Luna, Ranking Member Garcia, and members of the committee, thank you for the invitation to appear and testify today. I served on the staff of the President John F. Kennedy Assassination Records Review Board for the final 3 years of its four-year lifespan, from August of 1995 through September of 1998. I was hired as a senior analyst on the military records team and was promoted early in 1997 to head the military records team, serving as chief analyst for military records until the ARRB shutdown on September 30th, 1998. During my time on the staff, in addition to securing the declassification and public release of military records related to Cuba and Vietnam policy, I was privileged to work extensively in the medical evidence arena and to serve as the review board's point man on issues related to the Zapruder film of President Kennedy's assassination. Although the review board was not empowered to reinvestigate the assassination or generate conclusions or findings of fact, the board did choose to attempt to clarify the record of certain aspects of the assassination by taking the depositions of 10 persons who participated in or who were present at the autopsy on President John F. Kennedy, and by later taking one additional joint deposition of 5 of the Dallas treating physicians. I served as the principal research assistant to the review board's general counsel, Jeremy Gunn, in preparing for and conducting our 10 depositions of the participants and witnesses to JFK's autopsy, and was present at all 10 of those depositions. Sworn testimony of our 10 deponents, as well as numerous written interview reports of additional unsworn medical witnesses, were all deposited in the National Archives in the JFK Records Collection without comment or endorsement. In subsequent years, I wrote a 5-volume memoir about my own personal conclusions regarding the medical evidence and explained the substantial ways in which the work of the ARRB staff significantly enhanced the totality of the medical evidence and our understanding of how President Kennedy was killed. Some outstanding questions were resolved, but many other questions were raised by the information we gathered, questions that remain unresolved today. This is the heart of my oral testimony here. Many Americans remain troubled today by the many conflicts within the JFK medical evidence and what they might mean, and they remain unsatisfied with the official conclusions offered up by both the Warren Commission in 1964 and the HSCA Forensic Pathology Panel in 1979. Based on my work as an analyst at the ARRB and as an independent researcher, I have concluded that there are ample reasons for the disquiet of so many of the American people, to wit, first, 8 different sets of photographs known with confidence to have been taken during the autopsy on JFK are not in the official collection today and never have been. Some autopsy photos in the official collection at the National Archives are in gross disagreement with the head and neck wounds universally observed on November 22, 1963, by the treating physicians at Parkland Hospital, which they recorded in precise detail in their treatment notes that day and in their subsequent 1964 testimony. At least 2 and possibly 3 JFK skull x-rays exposed at Bethesda Naval Hospital are missing today and have never been in the official collection. The science of optical densitometry reveals that all 3 surviving skull x-rays are not originals, but rather are altered copy films. 2 highly qualified and respected MDs, who were granted repeated access by the Kennedy family to the autopsy photographs and x-rays and the deed of gift collection at the archives, both agree that the extant JFK skull x-rays reveal unambiguous and clear evidence of 2 headshots fired from in front of the president, contrary to the findings of the Warren Commission and the HSCA. The JFK skull x-rays actually reveal a total of 3 headshots, 1 from behind and 2 from the front. The so-called Harper fragment of skull bone, a crucial item of evidence signed for by the president's military physician and photographed and x-rayed by the FBI, has been missing since late in 1963. Many bullet fragments known to have been removed from President Kennedy's body at Bethesda Naval Hospital were never placed into the official record and are missing today. The remains of President Kennedy's brain following its examination were placed in a stainless steel container in 1963, but the brain is missing today, as many people know already. That stainless steel container and an original signed autopsy report were among materials transferred from the Secret Service to Senator Robert F. Kennedy in April of 1965. Those materials and others were not among the materials returned to the U.S. government by RFK on October 31st, 1966, via a deed of gift to the National Archives. The Kennedy family attorney, Dirk Marshall, told the HSCA that Robert F. Kennedy had made those materials permanently inaccessible without providing details. The 14 brain photographs in the National Archives today cannot be and are not photographs of John F. Kennedy's brain. They have been impugned by the official photographer at the brain examination and by one of the FBI agents present at JFK's autopsy. The chain of custody of President Kennedy's body prior to the start of the autopsy shortly after 8 p.m. on November 22, 1963, clearly appears to have been broken, casting even more doubt upon the reliability of the official autopsy report. And finally, Navy pathologists arrived at four sets of differing conclusions about President Kennedy's wounds and how he died within the 2 weeks after his death. The official autopsy report that is now in the National Archives represents only the fourth and final set of conclusions. This fact, perhaps more than any of the others above, is patently unacceptable in the nation that prides itself as the world's greatest democracy. In my concluding paragraph, I wish to make a short statement about the Zapruder film of the assassination. Studies in Hollywood of the individual film frames, that is, state-of-the-art digital scans of extremely high resolution, appear to show the use of visual effects, that is, animation or artwork, that crudely and blatantly altered the image content in some key frames. To state the problem simply, the digitized Zapruder film studied by professionals in Hollywood does not show the massive exit wound in the rear of the head seen at Parkland Hospital and by many witnesses at Bethesda during the autopsy, because it has been blacked out. And yet the film does appear to show head wounds not seen at Parkland Hospital. We now know that rather than spending the entire weekend following the assassination in Chicago at the Life printing plant, as was originally claimed, the Zapruder film actually spent most of the weekend in the custody of the CIA in Washington, D.C., and at Kodak's main research and development laboratory in Rochester, New York. The attitude of one National Archives official, expressed in writing circa 2009, was that they, quote, do not ever intend to take the film out of the freezer again, end quote. This decision should be overturned, and the so-called purported original film could be made available for appropriate inspection by qualified film professionals from the motion picture industry and academia, and by that I mean film schools, so that questions of authenticity can be definitively resolved. I've provided many additional details in my written testimony, and I request that they be included in the congressional record. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Horn, and they will.
Next week on The End of Innocence, the JFK assassination, we will hear questions from the congressional panel to the witnesses that testified in Tuesday's hearing. Then the following week, we will cover part two of what we started last week, what Warren Report defenders and supporters must believe in order to claim Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone or even was an assassin at all in the death of President Kennedy. If you like what you hear every week and want to learn more about the assassination, please pick up my book, The End of Innocence, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's available right now on Amazon, or you can find it at www.endofinnocencejfk.com. In honor of the release of the JFK assassination records, I'm sending out signed copies of my book. If you would like one of these, please email me at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. The price is $40 for the soft cover and $60 for the hardcover, plus shipping and handling. I can promise you, you won't be disappointed in the book. It's an oversized coffee table style book. The book is over 500 pages with almost 1,000 pictures. You won't be disappointed. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. We'll see you next week.